Is it possible to put something above that radiator that might act in a parasitic manner and just try and get that up and out? Thanks.
Yeah, I see what you're trying to do, and I think the answer, Dave, is not easily. Describe to me the materials of the building. If your attic happens to be made out of wooden rafters and a wooden ridgepole and asphalt shingles, on HF frequency, getting out of there is pretty easy. If it's a metal roof and a steel-girdered building, life's going to be a lot more difficult. So tell me a little bit more about the construction of your building, and your attic is how many feet off the floor, off the ground, or how many stories up, Dave? Go ahead.
Choice one, just a regular wooden structure with the asphalt. Again, I'm on the second floor here. I'm taking advantage of the attic up here. That's the idea. I just wanted to improve, and also to try and reduce what's coming down into the building with some of this stuff I found on lessems.com. It's some shielding material, silver mesh fabric, nickel alloy foil, other forms of shielding that I thought maybe if I could place under it, then also that would reduce the RF into the building, and then if I could assist that with something similar to a Yagi design where it would sort of parasitic, you kind of launch it up out of the building as well.
Yeah, stand by a second, I'll be right back with you.
Okay, KC2RPE, standing by.
Okay, I think the answer is no. In the case of a long wire antenna, and you haven't said, but I'm going to guess you'd like to use it. In fact, let me find out. What bands would you like to use the antenna on first? Let's hear that one first, Dave. On 80 meters, you're in a lot of trouble trying to do what you're trying to do. On 10 meters, you stand a chance. So your long wire, you'd like to light it up on which bands, Dave?
Well, preferably 40. That would be probably the choice, especially right now with the sunspot cycle, but I'll take whatever I can get.
Okay. When it comes to directing a signal in some particular direction, it takes real estate, and that real estate must have dimensions of wavelengths. A Yagi antenna, for instance, on 40 meters, each of the elements of the Yagi would be 66 feet long. The spacing between the elements would be, I don't know the exact number, something like 15 to 20 feet, and some number of those elements with that kind of spacing. You're talking about a pretty massive structure. It takes objects, in other words, parasitic elements, reflectors, directors, and so on, that are a good fraction of a wavelength away and approximately a half wavelength long in order to have significant steering capability. For you in that attic, which probably has a floor-to-ceiling distance of about 8 or so feet, which is such a small fraction of a wavelength at 40 meters, on top of that, it's not top to bottom you're worried about. You're trying to get that signal out of your attic at, let me pick a number, a 20-degree elevation angle. You'd like to be squirting that signal 20 degrees above the ground toward the horizon, toward the ionosphere, in the direction of your buddy in London or whatever. Whatever DX you're looking for, you do about the best I think you can do would be to set up a wire beam where you've got a driven element that's approximately 66 feet long, not counting the capacitive loading of all the stuff that's in your attic, which might include tinfoil or plumbing and wiring and whatever. All these things are going to disturb the electrical length a little bit. And you can readjust for that. And if you could set up 10 or 15 feet away from the driven element, another element, which becomes a director or a reflector, and if the house has the right orientation, north, south, east, west, you could get 2 or 3 dB of gain in a particular direction by building a two-element Yagi in that attic. But to put a sheet of material, good common sense would lead you to believe that a sheet of material is going to be more reflective than a simple piece of wire is a director. Good common sense. Well, doesn't work that way. When you take a piece of wire as a director or reflector and it has the right electrical length, it becomes a sheet of metal in electrical performance that's so big you couldn't afford it. You wouldn't want to pay for it, and you don't have the room in the attic to build it, if you know what I mean. That sheet of metal equivalent that the reflector I just described would extend out into the air beyond your attic and down into the next floor, so to speak. You wouldn't want to be putting up a real sheet of metal there. So give up the idea of a reflecting planar surface. If you're going to do anything at all, it's going to be another piece of wire. So if your building is oriented the right way, you set up these wires, extra wire as a director or reflector, that will allow you to modify the pattern. That will give you some extra gain. Other than that, you're not going to get it easily. And the word long wire usually means an antenna multiple wavelengths long. One single wavelength on 40 meters is 130 feet. I'm having trouble believing that your building, unless you're a fairly rich man there, Dave, I think very few of the people in Linden have a private residence that is multiple times 130 feet long. But maybe you do. So maybe I'm giving you a little bit of feeling of what will work and what I think will not work. Don't take only my opinion for it. Check with all your other buddies that you can talk to. Maybe some of them have built some pretty fancy antennas that are stealthy, that do what you want. The fact that it's stealthy implies that you've got a landlord, and therefore you don't own the whole building. Maybe the building is quite a bit bigger, and maybe you have access to the attic. I can remember one of the rental houses I was in, there was an access door through a closet of my apartment, which got me into the attic. I had a second floor apartment on a two-story garden apartment that gave me access to the roof had I stayed there long enough, I was going to put all kinds of things in that attic space. And maybe that's where you are, Dave. KC2RPE, K2LIW.
Studio pick.
Rich recognized, but Dave first, go ahead.
Okay, thanks for giving me some pointers on that, Dick. No, I don't have that. that large of a building. No, that's the smaller size, definitely. Just trying to see if I can maximize what I had. As for the other part of this is to limit the RF coming down into the building. I came across this website, lessemf.com, and they have all kinds of shielding materials, everything from foil to plastic sheeting. Would I be interested in, if I wanted to try and block that out down into the building, would I be interested in something that blocked magnetically or electrically? And that would that might help me out.
KC2NJY. KC2NJY recognized, and you're F2N2EO, and I've got a lot of comments on this one. Should you go for electrical shielding or magnetic shielding? And I think the answer is no and no. It ain't going to work. I am guessing the lessemf.com company is selling shielding materials which has the capability of doing a good job of shielding at, say, VHF frequencies and above. Once you radiate a signal into a long wire on 40 meters, 7 megacycles, into a wire in a building, or no matter where, you radiate a signal into that wire, and you try to shield that signal in certain directions. That is an extremely difficult problem. Let me give you an example of what I think is a possibility. Let's assume now that your wire is hanging from the ridge board of the attic. Let's assume the attic is made out of normal rafters and a ridge board. The ridge board is the highest board that goes across the length of the attic, and you hang your wire from that 8 feet above the floor of the attic. And now across the floor of the attic, you spread a perfect sheet of aluminum with no seams that covers the whole floor. Common sense would lead you to believe that, hey, I've made a perfect shield between that wire and that piece of metal, and now the signals down below are going to be completely shielded, and they're not going to get any television interference, any telephone interference, any radio interference. Good common sense. Not true. First of all, when you put that sheet of metal a few feet below your wire, you're going to have to do a tremendous amount of retuning of your wire. The impedance of the wire, which used to be 70 ohms, is going to go down to about 5 ohms because a very small fraction of a way, you've got this huge ground plane of aluminum. But you could readjust that. With a good antenna tuner, you can conquer that problem. I give you that one. And will it change the pattern out to the horizon? Very little. Will it shield the people down below? By a couple of dB, maybe 3 or 4 dB. You'd like to knock down the signal that's going down below into the living quarters by 20 dB so that they don't get any interferences anymore. Will that approach do it? Absolutely not. To really shield a signal takes a six-sided box with well-contacted aluminum on all of those seams. You've only got one side of the box. The RF energy will crawl around the edges of your aluminum and go down into the building and only be a couple of dB weaker. I'm not saying it won't work. I'm saying it's a heroic effort that's going to give you a minuscule performance improvement as far as shielding the living quarters are concerned. You're way ahead of the game to use inverse square law. If by some magic you can take that wire antenna and place it a greater number of feet away from the living quarters of the people that are being offended, that'll make a huge improvement. The nice thing about wire antennas is that only ham radio operators see wire. Normal people do not see wire. If by way of a slingshot, bow and arrow, or whatever, with nearby trees and other support structures, and maybe even using another nearby building, if you've got a friendly super that'll let you do it, you hang a wire between buildings, between trees, or whatever, and put it a greater number of feet away. And the wire itself can be a 30-gauge wire that's essentially invisible. I wouldn't. I'd go down a 20-gauge wire. Don't worry about its visibility. As I said, only hands see wire. Normal people do not. I mean, every one of the streets we all drive up and down, every 60 feet or so, you've got a utility pole with all kinds of wires between them. The population no longer sees those utility poles and no longer see those wires unless during a storm and a tree falls on it, one of the high tension wires falls to the ground, then they see the wire. Or if a car hits the telephone pole, then they see the telephone pole. The rest of the time, they don't see it. So there's other ways you can set up a stealthy antenna outside of the building. So in my opinion, you're going to get a lot more bang for the dollar by placing the antenna further away from the people to try to shield the signal in that direction and still radiate well into space. It's almost a conflict of interest. I think it will not work. That's an opinion, strongly felt opinion, not the last word on it. Let's see what Rich has got to say, and then NJY in that order. Rich first, N2EO. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. I was going to suggest also inverse square law, getting away from the offending area. One thing you might look at on page 87 of the current ham radio AES catalog, summer 2007. The antenna that's been on the market for years, I personally have not tried it, but you've been talking about the infinitesimal dipole. It's called the Isotron. ISOTRON. They've got a 40-meter model, $88.99. Dimensions of 2 inches by 16 inches by 16 inches. And he claims that it covers 250 yards of the 40-meter band. They're made for limited space. They got the heavy band from 160 to 6 meters. Back to net.
Yeah, I am familiar with the Isotron antenna. And it's a highly tuned, relatively compact object you can put in the shack with you. That's the good news. And it does have 90-some-odd% radiation efficiency. You put 100 watts into it, and 90-some-odd watts of it is radiated to space. And when you QSY, you have to do a little bit of retuning. It's only a couple hundred kc wide at the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio point. Those are minor annoyances, but you can live with that. But if he brings that Isotron antenna into his attic or into his living quarters, the amount of feet of spacing between that antenna and the offended people who are getting the interference is not going to increase. inverse square law, just to make it clear to people who are not familiar with it, says, and this is a basic law of physics, of any kind of a transmitting system. Doesn't matter if it's transmitting light, heat, radio, whatever. The inverse square law says that whenever you double the distance between you and the source of signal, you get one quarter of the amount of signal. 1/2 squared, double the distance. If I go 10 times the distance, 1/10 squared, which equals 100, I get 1%, 1/100. So multiply the distance by 10, you get 1% of the energy you used to get. Multiply the distance by 2, you get 1/4. So once you understand inverse square law, you realize that distance makes a huge difference. Let me give you an example of where this really comes roaring home loud and clear. Let's assume now that your town board gives you a notice that the so-and-so cell phone company is about to put a cell phone base station on the piece of commercial property directly next door to your house. The average guy getting that kind of a letter in the mail would go bonkers. He would say, holy cow, they're going to put this billion-watt thing with a 150-foot-high pole on the property next door to me with a zillion antennas on the top radiating all that RF energy. My kids are going to get cancer. My dog is going to have this deformed puppies. My cat's not going to live. You know, they go through all these scenarios. Good sounding common sense. Radio frequency biohazard. RF radiation. Directly next door to me. Intolerable. 99% of the population would say that. Once you understand inverse square law, once you understand that each individual carrier on each individual channel coming out of that cell phone base station cannot be stronger than 30 watts, which to the average ham radio operator is just a little bit more than QRP. And because the tower is 150 feet high and it's on the adjacent piece of property, the shortest possible slant range between that antenna doing that radiating, not even counting the fact that the antenna pattern is squirted out to the horizon and you're down under the umbrella of that antenna pattern, not even counting that. Assume you've got a three-story building directly next door, and your bedroom looks directly into that antenna, and the slant range between you and it is 200 feet. Boy, you would have nightmares over that. But when you pick up that cell phone, which runs as much of as a third of a watt, depending on how far away you are from the cell phone base station, it adjusts its power according to distance just to maintain the communication. It's a power-managed system. You put that cell phone against your ear, and that antenna is 1/4 inch away from your head, radiating 1/3 watt. That cell phone against your head is 1,000,000 times stronger RF energy into your body than if you lived directly next door to that huge cell phone base station structure. You try telling that to a zoning board. You're standing on solid bedrock. You're talking good, strong physics here of inverse square law. The differences of the distance counts a lot. 1/4 inch versus 200 feet, you go through the mathematics, and you go through the differences in power, the answer is 1,000,000 to 1 in the opposite direction of what you would think. In other words, anybody using a cell phone is getting 1,000,000 times more power than if they lived directly next door. Therefore, if you try to make sure that you're going to show up to that zoning hearing, and you're going to make sure you vote down that the siting of that cell phone base station on the commercial property next door to your house, and if you do it because of a perceived risk of radio frequency biohazard, you're wasting your time. There's a federal law that will fight you. Communication Act of 1996 says you cannot do that. It dictates that every zoning board cannot deny the siting of a cell phone base station based on a perceived risk of radio frequency biohazard. The federal government has been down that road a whole lot of time, studied the situation. There is no risk from that. Not little risk, none. If you think there's a risk, then the million times stronger thing, cell phone, you better stop using it. And on the other side of the coin, I know people who are so radio frequency biohazard conscious, my relatives that live in Bayville, that they will not even operate a cell phone when their child is in the house with them. I think it's extreme. They're trying very hard to make sure their children are in a very safe situation. Their motivation is good. It's excessive, in my opinion. So, as you can see, inverse square law is extremely important in many situations. So, in your particular situation there, Dave, anything you can do to increase the distance between your antenna, no matter what kind of an antenna it is, if you increase the distance between that antenna and your people who are getting interference, you'll make a huge improvement to try to shield the signal in one direction, but radiate in all other directions. It's a conflict of interest, and unless you're an extremely rich man, I don't think it can be made to work. That's an opinion. All right, we had, I think, another person who wanted to say, KC2NJY, I think it was. You wanted to make a comment. Please start off with your name, sir, and then add your comment. My name is Dick.
Yes, hello, Dick. My name is Eric from Larchmont, New York. I actually don't have a comment. I actually had a question, actually a couple of questions, just tuning into this net for the first time. May I proceed?
Negative. You're now on the list of the people who are ahead of you, and I think there's only one person ahead of you, Rick. This TechNet has run now for 24.8 years, and in the beginning we take a list of names of people who sign in with a question or a comment, and your name has now been added to the list. I think there's only one person ahead of you. Let me think now. Who is ahead of you? Did we cover everyone? Have I skipped anyone? Oh, let's see now. Bob, Mr. PNJ, thought he had no question. Let's give him, and Mr. QIW also, KC2QIW, I think it is. Bob, W2PNJ, you have an opportunity if you want to. Go right ahead, Bob.
And WS2N had one question, Dick.
Yeah, Paul, I forgot about you. You're on the list. Bob, you did say you have a question or don't have a question, Bob.
WB2HWW, the comment on the subject.
Okay, go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, I've been listening a little bit. The best thing is shielding is not going to solve. I agree with you. You've got to get the antenna as high as possible above the plate. You know, if it was my brother, I'd rather have the antenna outside the attic, vertically up, get as high above the building as possible. That's always the answer. Get yourself above all the other antennas, and, you know, that will give you the best filtering, the separation. Distance is your friend.
Absolutely right. Good old inverse square law. Okay, I think I'm getting a little bit fuzzy in the brain here. NJY, I gave him. Oh, yes, he's got a question he's going to ask. Paul, yeah, we forgot about Paul. Paul normally is giving us information on the space information. I put him in my space file, but I happen to have a symbol alongside of it, so he's got a question, and I didn't look in the right place. Sorry about that, Paul. WS2N, go right ahead.
Okay, it's really probably a quick question, a very quick question. I don't think Rick's going to have much of a weight, but this relates to the sockets that we all plug our ham radios into. You know, the these receptacles in the wall. My house is here, what, 1979, and they have these push connections for all these receptacles. Now, years ago, I don't know, maybe 12, 15 years ago, I had a problem with one operating HF at the regular base at the time, and both the lights just went out. Well, it took me the whole part of that night and half the next day to try to find out where the disconnect was, you know, the circuit breaker is going to go. But this box, I finally found a box, and the box happened to be upstairs, so, you know, I was downstairs, connected in series with downstairs, you know, one house that had started the house, powered, and then if that goes down, the other, you still got the other half, one of those deals. Well, these receptacles have these push connections in it, and when I had changed that out, I said I don't want that. Once the store, I sort of push connections. You know what I mean? You push it in. It's kind of like the Japanese type of thing. You push it in. You can't pull it out. Like the finger things that you put your fingers in, it just doesn't come back out again. I think those things I think they should be outlawed. You know, at that time. So sure enough, I get another receptacle, the screw type, and I screw the connectors on. I figure that's the way to go, and I'm sure I'm right about that. And just the other day, an outdoor receptacle, same thing, you know. I go out there with my power drill, gonna clean up something, a little rust near the tower.
the pipe tower. Pull the trigger. Thing goes off. I think, well, maybe it's the GFI. Check out the GFI. Everything's fine. Sure enough, I take the receptacle apart, and it's the same type of steel. This wire is loose. I mean, you could move it around. Put that completely out. Put another one in. I was wondering, are these things now outlawed? This one store I went to, I didn't see them anymore. Naturally, I did get the screw type tight down on the wires. I wonder if these things are maybe outlawed or should be. Or what do you think about these connectors? They work good for years, maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 years later, all of a sudden you get these problems. Or maybe you think they're better than the screw type. I don't know. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
KC2MDP, comment.
Go ahead, Steve.
In the electrical industry for about 25 years now. Yeah, those things in the back there, it's called feed wiring. It's basically a, labor-saving device, rather than wrap the wire around the screw. As far as them being outlawed, there is a code that says you can no longer feed through. In other words, you have the outlet, you have a feed coming into your outlet, a hot and a neutral, and then you have a feed going out. You've got to be pigtailed. But as far as feed wiring goes itself, it's still legal, believe it or not. And I wish they would outlaw it myself. I've been in plenty of houses where I've seen the same exact problem. Back to you.
Very good, Steve. That's almost what I was going to say. If they're not outlawed, they are outlawed in my mind. I will not use them. The only thing I trust is a piece of copper wire wrapped under a screw and the screw screwed down tightly. I don't care if it takes me an extra 5 minutes to hook up a outlet in that manner. You hook up that outlet correctly, it's going to work without trouble for you for the next 30 years, whereas the speed wiring push-on type thing, there's so little area of contact, so unreliable a contact, I do not trust it. If I was in your situation, Steve, thank goodness my house is so darn old, but those speed wiring things didn't even exist. I've got a house that's got cartridge fuses, but at least I've got real copper wiring with real screws under each one, and I haven't had that particular problem. I'd be tempted to replace an awful lot of those in the critical areas of your house. I think the more trouble, the worse. So glad you were able to detect it. We're glad it doesn't cost you a whole lot of money, but it is going to cost you some man hours to replace those darn things, and I think they're unreliable. And they're great for contractors. In other words, if I was the low bidder and I won the contract to rewire all the houses in Levittown in 1944, I'd love to have those things because I could wire twice as many houses per day with the same number of men. And that's great as far as getting the house up and running today. And the fact that some number of years downrange are going to create a problem, well, that particular contractor is gone. His name has changed. He's out of business. You no longer can get to him. He's free as a bird. And why the Underwriters Laboratory will allow this is a bit amazing to me. Back to you on this one, Paul. WS2N, KQLIW.
W2PNJ.
Okay, Dick, and one other comment relating to this. I hear PNJ in there. Dick, the when you operate CW, I'm going out 100 watts barefoot. How many amps I'm drawing? 15, 20 amps, whatever it is. Every time this is now years ago, not now. Because I definitely changed out that one particular socket, but you can see the light dimming just that little bit every time you transmit. And for a long time, I'm thinking, well, RF problems, this and that. And it wasn't until I changed out this socket that, that really went away. And I wonder if you agree with that. I mean, well, was that a coincidence? I just really believe that, you don't have a good connection on that. And, what I'm doing is creating a problem, not RF-wise, but, power-wise. The lights in the house would actually dim for every dip dot that you send there.
It's awful good that you found that. That's a fire hazard. Well, let's assume now that you were getting, I'm going to pick a number, 2 volts drop on that poor contact of that speed wiring that you had in that socket. Now let's assume that your particular transmitter key down drew 10 amperes. 10 amperes of 2 volts drop is 20 watts of dissipation in that tiny little socket where that push-on wire goes. You put 20 watts of dissipation there for a long enough period of time, there's a slim possibility that wire can get hot enough to create a fire. So, poor contacts and the people who used to have aluminum wiring in the house and all the fire hazards that created are now seeing the mechanism of it. A very little bit of voltage drop at high current represents a whole lot of wattage, and that wattage can create fires because it's wattage is heat. And if the aluminum wire or the copper wire and everything around it can't tolerate the heat, you've got fire. And that ain't good. Let's see what Bob's going to say. W2PNJ, K2LIW.
I'm in the electrical contracting business since 1970. Same corporate name, same business. It's a family business. About 20 years ago, well, even earlier, around the mid-70s, those were very popular, those back wire devices. The trouble is, we wired some houses in the Smithtown area with those devices, but it turned out to be very expensive because the reason is, like I said, within 6-8 months, you were getting callbacks because of circuits going out, and there you would spend a half a day to try to find this device that had an intermittent contact problem. So what we're going to do is we went back and changed all the outlets out because once you do the job under wire under screw, you never have to come back. So anybody that uses those outlets today, and P.S., when I moved into my house in 1968, it's 100% copper wire house, but they had all those devices. I took the time and the material to go out to the entire house to replace all those outlets that were wired in by a union electrician.
That's one hell of a testimonial, Bob. Thank you. In your opinion, why in the world has the Underwriters Laboratory allowed this tragedy to continue? Back to you, Bob.
Well, the tragedy was, worst-case scenario, is when they were using the aluminum wiring, which took place around the years 1970, early 1970s, they were back-wiring these devices with 12-gauge aluminum, you know, for 15-amp circuits. And that was a disaster. And since then, you cannot use that aluminum wire, you know, under such conditions. In fact, you can't use a 12-gauge wire on a back-wire device anymore.
And I think the only way you could use aluminum wiring if you want to do a repair is the so-called pigtailing process, which is a little bit elaborate and labor-intensive. Is that true, Bob?
Yeah, those are special. Years back they had the special crimping. Now they have the special wire nuts that you can buy. They're purple in color, and you can use that for pigtailing.
So if a person had aluminum wiring in his house, would your recommendation be to go back and use purple wire nuts and pigtail every one of those carefully, or would you even go to the next level of enthusiasm and literally bypass all the aluminum wiring and put in real copper wiring? Which would you do if it was your house, Bob?
Every time I would renovate a room, I would replace the wiring in the wall. So you're doing it stages. The quick fix, of course, is pigtailing, but if you're in the process of renovating your home, absolutely. You know, get to the point where you can go in there and replace the circuitry with copper wire.
And while we're on the subject of household wiring, and maybe Bob will box me on this one, there is a condition that occurs occasionally here. It's called the dim-bright problem. And let me explain that. The transformer that's out of the street that steps the 7,800 volts of distribution voltage down to the 120, 240 volts that you use in your house, that is a primary-secondary transformer, and the secondary winding is approximately 240 volts with center tap. So there are three wires coming into your house. The center tap, everyone calls neutral, and hopefully it's connected to a piece of 6-gauge wire that goes to the butt plate on the bottom of the telephone pole that grounds it, and also that neutral wire comes into your house, and it connects to the fuse box ground, neutral, and it gets grounded to water pipe or a bit of ground, but it gets grounded in multiple places in ideal wiring, the neutral wire. And now, your red and your black wire are the two phases of 120, I'm going to call it, 115, 120. And across the red and black is where your electric range and your electric dryer goes in order to get 240 volts, get the whole secondary winding. But half of your house is on the red wire for 120 volts with reference to neutral. The other half of your house is on the black wire, 120 volts with reference to neutral. If, for some reason, that neutral wire doesn't make perfect contact all the way from that transformer into the neutral of the fuse box of your house, if it doesn't make perfect contact all the way, and in my house, that particular wire happened to be a piece of aluminum outside the house that eventually developed an intermittent contact, you get the situation where you turn on one particular appliance in the house, you realize it's a heavy draw appliance that's running on less than normal voltage, and the light bulb in some other part of the house starts getting bright. And what's happening is that as long as the current drain on each side is absolutely identical, in theory, you don't need that center tap connection. Without that center tap, though, it's maintaining the balance. You could get, instead of 120 volts, you can get 160 volts on one side, 40 volts too much, and you can get 40 volts too little on the other side, 80 volts instead of 120. That's the so-called dim-bright problem, if that neutral wire is not making good contact. So whenever you're in a house and you turn on an appliance and the light dims or get too bright anywhere else, I recommend you stop and investigate it. It's potentially dangerous as far as damaging the equipment. It's potentially dangerous as far as fire. It's potentially dangerous as far as proper neutral grounding is concerned for human safety. I bet you Bob's going to have a couple of extra words on this one. W2PNJ, K2RIW, the tech man.
WA2CDL.
CDL recommendation recognized. Dick, you're right on target. Yeah, that's an open neutral condition. Very dangerous. That's why if you're running a three-wire circuit in a house, two hots in the neutral, they mandatory that you always wire nut your neutrals together as you branch off into other circuits. If you come in like with a 14-3 feed and you're going to branch out with two 14-2s, those neutrals must be wire nutted, and then you go to your first particular device. You can never break that neutral over because of that problem.
Okay, Andy, go right ahead with your comment.
Okay, very good. Brings back some memories, Dick. WHCDL here. And hello to you, Bob, anyone else. I've been listening in a little bit also. Dick, if you remember, you paid me a visit when I lived in Merrick. And this goes back to early 80s, early to mid 80s. Just to let you know, we've had many incidents in that house due to aluminum wiring that was installed. The house was built in 1967. And I remember one hot summer afternoon, we had an attic fan that would exhaust the hot air in the house. We didn't have central air, we just had an attic fan. And we had the attic fan on, and I was downstairs, and I smelled something burning. And it was the day that changed forever. I go upstairs and I see my sister's bedroom filled with smoke, and I see smoke pouring out of the wall. And I take a look, and sure enough, the outlet is melting. The whole outlet itself is on fire. Fortunately, it did not set the sheetrock on fire, just the outlet itself. But the smoke from the hot plastic being melted, toxic as well, was filling up the room. So immediately I turned the circuit breaker off, and when things cooled down, I looked and I said, aha, this is aluminum wiring. And what happened was the screws, due to the expansion and contraction, the screws became loose, and it was arcing. And due to the high current that the attic fan was drawing in that circuit, to the same circuit as the outlet, in this particular case, it was drawing all that current, got hot, was arcing, and started to melt the plastic. It's a good thing I was home at the time. Who knows what would have happened. From that point on, I took every outlet apart in the house, and I pigtailed every outlet. That was the turning point. I said, this is this is not going to happen again. And it was a big job, had to do a lot of outlets, but that's what I had to do. So, never again. Go ahead, Dick, WHCEO.
You were extremely lucky, Andy. An engineer named Ed, and I'm having trouble thinking of his last name, a good engineer I worked with for a lot of years at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, had an attic fan with an aluminum-wired house, and he suddenly realized one day he was out in the backyard, looked up at the attic fan that was in a window, and he realized it wasn't turning at the right rate, and he thought he saw some smoke coming out of that exhaust fan. By the time he got up to the second floor, the whole second floor of the house was in flame. The heat, he had to crawl along the floor to make sure that no one was in the bedroom on the second floor, because when he lifted his head up any higher, he would be singeing his hair with the hot gases that were up above him. The bottom line is that no one got injured, everyone got out of the house, and most of the house burned to the ground because of an exhaust fan drawing high current with aluminum wiring that started to fail. So it's something to be very sensitive about. It's extremely easy to turn on an appliance, see the light get a little bit dimmer, and say, yeah, my house is old and it's not adequately wired. That's giving you a very strong clue. Don't ignore it. If that light gets dim when you turn on an appliance, and some other light gets bright when you turn on that appliance, as I said, don't ignore it. You're on the threshold of some pretty serious smoke and flames, if you know what I mean. Very little voltage drop at high current represents a tremendous number of watts. Those watts represent heat. The heat represents potential fire, and fire in a house ain't good. You can quote me on that. Anyone with any further comments on this pleasant subject? It's a left-handed joke. KQRIW listening. Okay, I think we've covered all the questions. Let me double-check before I go over to Rick. Have I covered all the questions of everyone we signed in tonight? KC2BZI, okay. You're right after Rick. Rick, KC2, November, Juliet, Yankee, you got the floor, sir. Rick, there is no beeper on this machine. Go right ahead. Okay, maybe Rick wasn't able to wait. KC2, Baker Zulu, India, I think it is. Start up your name, sir, and then proceed with your question. My name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. It's Kilo Charlie 2, Bravo Zulu, India. The name is Edwin. Don't call me Eddie. My question is about what you're talking about when it comes to wiring up the house. The occasion, let me see, I've done it 1, 2. I put in a water fountain. I ran an electric wire for that. I also ran an electric wire outside for a street lamp in front of the house. And I'm hearing, I got copper wire in the house. And would you have an idea? I believe I did the job right. I've got relays going, and could be 40-watt bolts, you know, not expensive bolts when it comes to pulling electricity. These new 14-watt bolts I got out there, you know, saves money as well. I don't put 360-watt bolts on one wire. I don't do that. I use the 14-watt bolts for that street chandelier. And near the front door, there's a switch to turn the light on the inside, and then it has another switch right next to it to turn the light on the street. And I believe I did it right. But I'm going to have this checked out by a professional. I believe I've discussed it with friends, and as far as it goes, it's done proper. I'm going to need a professional to come in and look at my wire, because I do want to put another light in. What would something like this cost? Do you have an idea? Or even a phone number of someone that I can call over?
First of all, although I may have a great authoritative sound to my voice, and I use the right buzzwords from time to time, you may think I know about electrical wiring. I know about some of the horrors of incorrect electrical wiring, Eddie, but I'm not an expert on this. The best expert we've got on station is Bob W2PNJ, who has been an electrical contractor since 1970. I'm relatively sure Bob is going to recommend that you do have it inspected. By the way, also, Eddie, you could use a little bit more audio. Because it's late at night, maybe you're speaking softly, but good, clean audio you've got, but it could be a little bit louder to fully fill up the machine, so to speak. I'm pretty sure Bob is going to recommend you do have it inspected just to be double darn sure that nothing is improper. And the additions that you're sounding like you're going to add sound very conservative. The fact you're using these new fluorescent light bulbs is also making you a very green person. I hear tell that our current governor of New York State is going to eventually, I think he's about to order that the high-efficiency fluorescent bulbs be used on all government buildings, and he's attempting to set a law where even private residences in New York State will be using those bulbs by law. I think he's trying to push for that. Let's see what Bob's got to say for any possible suggestion. I'm not quite sure what town you live in. Bob lives over there in New Jersey, but maybe there is a central number you can call to get a licensed inspector. W2PNJ, any suggestions for Eddie? K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, you asked the right question. What town is he in?
Eddie, what town are you in?
Babylon. Okay, Long Island Inspection Service, service. They're in St. James, New York, and they handle that town. Give them a call. Give me a minute. Let me look up the number. I'll get back to you.
Told you we got the right guy. Long Island Inspection Service. Sounds good. And sounds like you're going to get it checked over correctly, and that way you can sleep easy on this one, Eddie. Bob, an amount of time to find that number. Let's go over to Paul, WS2N, to tell us what's going on in space. I think this coming Tuesday, the astronauts come home. They're coming home a little bit early to try to avoid the hurricane, although maybe the hurricane has already passed them. And last I heard, they're not going to be attempting to repair that 3-inch gash that's in the heat tiles of the space shuttle. And I'm also skeptical as to whether or not anyone has really worked out all the fine details of doing a repair in space in the hard vacuum. I mean, if I wanted to do a repair on Earth and I take some the correct kind of an epoxy or any other kind of a hardening substance and I smear it into a crack and I wait for it to dry and harden, I can see how I can get a good bond. To do that in the hard vacuum of space, where you get continuous thermal cycling every 45 minutes, 45 minutes of continuous sunlight, 45 minutes of intense darkness on the backside of the Earth on each one of those orbits, you get that thermal cycling and hard vacuum. I'm not convinced there's any hardening substance in the world you could use that's going to do a good repair job in that environment. Maybe I'm wrong. WS2N, K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
Okay, Dick, very good. Yeah, Tuesday they're coming back. Originally Wednesday. They have the capability of course staying up there longer. They did have that connection between the shuttle and the International Space Station. First time on its orbit, it was able to really plug into the space station to draw power from those big solar panels. So, you know, an original 11-day mission gave them an extra 3 days if they wanted it, probably more, of course, but they decided to separate from the space station a day early because of Hurricane Dean. They didn't want to take a chance of having the storm go north and taking out Houston. If that was the case, they always have plans on bringing members of the ground team on Houston to Florida and use that as a secondary base, mission control to land the shuttle. To avoid that, they are going to come home one day early, I think, so that's why they've undocked. And as far as the repair and space, yeah, I kind of thought they'd let that go. Aerodynamics come into play. If you put this putty on, that would have been a cure. There's three other different methods. One is a plate, bubbling it on, highly unlikely that they were going to do that. But this putty type method, putting that in that area, 3x2-inch crack in the belly of the space shuttle, seemed unlikely since they showed pictures from a 1988 flight where it was much bigger area that was opened up, and that successfully came back 2,300 degrees max on the belly. Usually in that area, they think the temperature would be around maybe 400 or 500 degrees, maybe 700 or 800 degrees before you start to deteriorate the aluminum body. Right below all those piles of aluminum. So they know they're within their guidelines. They did some tests, duplicated what they have there, and they're confident that should come back okay. I often wonder, they have these three different methods of repairing piles. They've taken them into space. They've applied them in the cargo bay, duplicating the process, seeing if manually the astronauts could do this in space. That's fine and dandy, but actually do it and then bring a shuttle back. I would go one step further. I would put these people in a vacuum chamber at cold temperatures on Earth in space, and I would apply this putty. I would put the panel on. I would do the three or four different methods that they have on different sections in a vacuum, and I would seal it up in a right there in that vacuum, and I would make a perfect vacuum out of it. I would put it into some kind of a unmanned spacecraft and launch the thing into space and then bring it back right through the atmosphere with parachutes and everything. And then I would have it land and I would examine it and see if it held up. And that's the only way to do it. They can't duplicate a 17,500 mile descent from space on Earth. They don't have wind tunnels capable of this. They don't have that facility. It's impossible. They don't have the physics to do that. So, launch it into space after it's been repaired in a cold vacuum on Earth, send it up, and send it through the atmosphere, deorbit it, and see how it holds up. I don't know why they haven't done this, or if they thought about it, or whatever, but, to have these procedures in place, and then apply it to a spacecraft, and then cross your fingers and hope seven astronauts come back okay. I don't know. I kind of worry about that. So they chose to leave it alone, not do anything. The cure could be worse than the disease, possibility of banging against the shuttle, destroying the piles. They're very brittle. You could very easily destroy these piles on the bottom if you bang into it. They're going to leave it alone and not do anything there. But it was a successful mission. They did their do what they wanted to do. They took the gyroscope, four on board. They brought one up with them. That's four on the space station. To keep the thing aligned right, the attitude correct. So that's going okay. They've done all of that. They saw the S5 truck segment, the spacer piece that's going to be between the starboard solar cell and the next solar panel that's going to eventually be brought up. And they installed the equipment that eventually is going to be used to look for all the problems on the files on future missions. They did that, and that's mounted on the S1 structure. That went well. And also, late at night, in the middle of the night, I recorded the C-SPAN teacher space program. That's, you know, this whole Barbara Morgan thing was about. Recorded that. That went good. She talked to all the kids in Virginia. Originally, that was supposed to happen some 21 years ago with Chris McCall on the Challenger mission. That went good. Kids got to ask their questions. She got to teach them space. And that's not the end of it. There's, I think, four more teacher in space or educator astronauts in line for future missions to the space station and eventually to the moon. So back to you, Dick. WS.
W2PNJ.
Go ahead, Bob.
Okay, it's Long Island Inspection Service. The fellow's name is Bill. The phone number is 265-3075. 265-3075. And his name is Bill. Very nice guy, and he'll be able to give you a... You call him up, you want an inspection survey, they'll be able to help you out. They're located in St. James. Over to you, Dick.
And being St. James, most likely that area code is 631. Do you think that's true, Bob?
That's correct.
Okay. Let's see if Eddie got that information. Any need a fill on that, Eddie? Maybe Eddie got called away, but if he comes back, I've got the phone number. Getting back to you, Paul, I think I heard a report earlier that during this mission, if I think this was the mission, that one of the astronauts that first did a spacewalk discovered that two or three of the layers of the five-layer glove had a failure, and so he was down to only one or two layers before the glove starts exposing him to the vacuum of space. I think he came back in, and hopefully they got a spare glove. Did that occur on this mission, Paul?
Yes, it did. Machiata, yeah. Oh, I forget how to pronounce his last name there. He had a problem. Two layers, like you said, there's five layers that are involved in that. But Machiata, yeah. I don't know. He's a Maine spacewalker. M-A-S-T-R-A-C-H-I-O, I have here. But, he doesn't know how he did it, but that's what they're worried about. They go out to Quest Lab. The Quest Lab is a module that's hooked up to the International Space Station. And go into this thing. Two spacewalkers will go in. Usually it's the day before, they'll even sleep there, and they'll be separated from the rest of the station, and they'll depressurize there for that day, and this way it's much easier for them to leave. They don't have this problem of depressurizing the whole space station. Everybody else is comfortable at 10.7 pounds. We're 14.7 pounds here. The station is 10.7. But they lower their pressure in the Quest Lab, and then they go out. So when you leave the Quest Lab, by the way, it's like jumping into the void, they say. It's really quite a feeling when you do that. Up, and you see Earth below you. There's nothing else. So they say it's a strange feeling going out of there. But somewhere along the line between there and his work area, he wound up with a tear in the glove. They would like to know where this happened, what happened. Was it a tool? Was it part of the space station? That's their biggest worry. He was in no danger. He had three more layers to go. He didn't depressurize. His eyes weren't going to pop out of his head. So, you know, you watch the news, you know, I saw a couple of news stories that, you know, you thought that was big problem that they ever had, but you know, if you go to the NASA site, you read their stories about it. He was in no danger. He's got three other layers to go. But where